Background information in the Old Testament, the first talk in a series entitled Did Jesus Have to Die, was presented by Jack Crabtree on March 30, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
First of all, I just want to give you fair warning. I think I'm toxic, having avoided viruses all winter. Little critters caught up with me in the last couple days, so I would stay away from me if I were you. I'm going to take a few weeks, 2-3 weeks, and we'll see how it goes, to address a question. I'll get back to Luke eventually, but before I do that, I wanted to address this question. I may insert another question before I get back to Luke as well. We'll see. But I want to ask the question, did Jesus have to die? Now, what I mean by that is, did Jesus have to die for your and my sins to be forgiven and for us to receive salvation? Or could God have offered salvation to mankind another way? Or, alternatively, a question is, did God have to become a man in order for mankind to be saved by God? Was the incarnation intimately connected with our salvation? Those are the questions that I ultimately want to get to. I won't answer those today. I want to get into background today, but that's where I'm headed in this short series that we have. The reason I asked that question is because a few months ago I proposed an alternative, non-traditional theory of the atonement, and the question has been raised by a number of people since then. Well, isn't that a problem? Doesn't that imply that Jesus didn't have to die? And wouldn't that basically debunk, wouldn't that implication debunk your view? So that's why I'm raising the question, and that's what we're concerned about. What I want to do this morning is look at the background in the Old Testament. And basically, I'm making a very simple point. I'll make it probably very complicated, but I'm making a very simple point here this morning, and that is that there is a view out there that if you look at the sacrificial system in the Old Testament, that one thing that comes through clear is that God was trying to teach Israel that if there is no death, if there is no shedding of blood, it's the way we like to describe it, there can be no forgiveness of sins. And that it's the Old Testament rituals and sacrifices and so on that teach us that. I'm going to argue that no such thing is implied by the Old Testament. So that's where I'm going. I'm gonna raise a question that I don't know anything about, or not anything significant about, and that is the offerings, the system of offerings in the Old Testament. I think it's an incredibly difficult subject. The passages that you have to look at are kind of cryptic and confusing and not overly brief. They don't always give you a context for what they're saying. And so to really understand the Old Testament sacrificial system would be a significant study where you're looking at all the information throughout all of the scriptures. So what I have to say here is very, very not very well informed. I think it's accurate as far as it goes, but there's just a whole lot more to know that I don't pretend to know. I want to make a distinction between offerings in the Old Testament, what some scholars call expulsion rituals or transfer rituals, what we call scapegoating, a scapegoat. I'll comment on a propitiatory offering in the Old Testament, and then ransom. That if you go back into the Old Testament, and now I'm going to speak generally for a second about the whole ancient world, the practices of the Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, that the Anatolians, the whole ancient world with their religious practices would typically include all of these kinds of offerings that we're talking about here today. So on the one hand, there was a system of offerings. Offerings were basically a gift that you were giving to the god. It was a token gift, typically. It may be of weight and value to you, but from the standpoint of God's valuation, it was just a token. And the purpose was largely to either restore your relationship to God or to express your commitment to God, your devotion to God, something of that nature. In the Old Testament, the gifts are often described as cleansing, as having a cleansing effect. The gift could be an animal. The gift could be grain. The gift could be, almost all of them were edible. In Mesopotamia, the reason they were edible is because the offerings were seen as food for the gods. If you read the Enuma Elish, the Sumerian creation account, it becomes very evident in the Enuma Elish that the whole purpose and the only purpose for mankind, as far as the gods are concerned, is so they don't have to work. We go and grow the food, and we bring the food to the gods that they might feast on the food and eat the food and take comfort, and they don't have to work for it. They don't have to toil for it. So somewhere in the deep recesses of cultural memory, there is this practice of literally feeding the gods with your gifts. Well, the practice of Israel was not any different outwardly than that. And in fact, on a few occasions, a handful of occasions, God will describe the gift to him in ways that are reminiscent of the Enuma Elish. We'll call it food. We'll talk about the soothing aroma of the burning food and that kind of thing. We'll talk about the significance of that in a second. But virtually, maybe universally, the offerings were edible and were things that were good for food. For example, the animals that were offered in Israel were always domesticated animals, and domesticated animals that were used as a part of their diet, not that were used as part of their workforce. You don't sacrifice a donkey in the Old Testament because you don't eat donkeys. You use them to bear your burdens. So it was the edible meat that were offered. The offerings could have several different purposes in the Old Testament, in the Mosaic Covenant, and they roughly break down into peace offerings, sin offerings, and guilt offerings. And that's what is so difficult to make sense of. One, getting the name of the offering to match the purpose is difficult to understand. I have no idea why a peace offering is called a peace offering. It might be a translation problem. I didn't get that far in my study. It might be a translation problem. But for the life of me, I don't see any relationship between this offering and peace in any sense that is meaningful to me. So I don't know why it's called a peace offering. A sin offering isn't really an offering for sin, as you and I would think of it. A sin offering seems to be largely concerned with making you ceremonially clean when you have inadvertently been made unclean. I don't think that's exclusively what a sin offering is used for, but that's one of the major purposes. The one that seems to have to do with sin is what's called the guilt offering. And the guilt offering is an offering that is offered when you have lied to someone, you have misrepresented the facts to someone, you have borne false testimony in a court of law, you have cheated someone in some way or stolen something from someone. One way or another, you have defrauded a person. And what was really interesting in looking at this, I'd never noticed this before, and all of these offerings are offered by people who have come to realize their sin. They've become aware of the fact that they have either become unclean or are morally guilty or whatever. That we'll come in on that again later, but that I think that's significant. These are offerings you're offering because it's a response that you as a person are making to the fact that you're aware that there is some disruption in your relationship with God. It has never occurred to me before, and I'm going to have to stew on this, and this may make a difference in other parts of my understanding of the New Testament as well. If we take the Mosaic Covenant seriously, there was no offering for the really egregious offenses, moral offenses, murder, adultery, idolatry, blasphemy. The covenant is pretty clear. If someone does one of those things, you're to stone them to death. You don't offer an offering for forgiveness. They are cut off from the people, of the covenant. And I think that that means to kill them. Okay, so those are offerings. They involve, in the Old Covenant, they involve coming before the priest with the appropriate offering. Whatever the appropriate offering was would depend upon your socioeconomic status to a certain extent. If you're incredibly poor, you may show up with a little grain offering. If you're wealthier, it's a goat or a bull or something appropriate. If it's an animal, the worshiper slits the throat of the animal and they collect the blood. That's one of the unique features of offerings in the Mosaic Covenant, is the role that blood plays. Typically in Greece, you slit the throat of the animal and you just let the blood soak into the ground. And it was no part of the ritual, not a big deal. Not so in Israel. In Israel, it's explicitly and self-consciously made a part of the ritual. So the blood is collected, and different things are done with the blood, sprinkled on the altar. In one offering, you take it into the Holy of Holies and sprinkle it on the mercy seat. In certain unique cases, you dab some of the blood on the right earlobe and right thumb. Various things are done. But then the animal is flayed, and the pieces of the meat are put on the offering and burned. Depending upon what kind of offering it is and why you're offering it, some of it might be given to the priest to have a sacred meal with in a sacred place. And depending upon the offering, some of it may be given back to the worshiper for the worshiper to have a ritualistic meal, eating the food. When that was the case, there was a certain prescribed time that you had to finish eating it. And if you hadn't eaten it within that prescribed time, you had to destroy the food, to burn the food. Those parts of the animal that were not made a part of the ritual, they were taken outside the camp usually and burned, different Hebrew word used. It's like you're like burning refuse. You're not ritually burning the offering, you're actually burning refuse. And it was important that you reduce that all to ashes. Okay, those are the offerings. You also have what are called expulsion rituals, and the classic one in the Mosaic Covenant is on the Day of Atonement. The high priest takes a bull that he's going to sacrifice, but he also has two goats, one of which is going to be a sacrifice, an offering. But the other goat, the high priest puts both hands on the goat. That reminds me, on all these offerings that I've just described, the worshiper puts one hand on the animal before the throat is slit. It seems to be some kind of indication of identification with the offering. This is my offering up to God. In the case of this goat on the Day of Atonement, the high priest puts two hands on the goat and confesses the sins of Israel, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, over the goat. And then the goat is taken by a person designated for the task, is led into the wilderness. The goat is not killed. no sacrifice is made of the goat. It's just, it's as if the sins of Israel are being heaped on and collected on the goat, and the goat is carrying them away, putting distance between Israel and its sins. And it's no more complicated than that. Again, that's a ritual that was reenacted in Greece and Mesopotamia and all the other parts of the ancient world. All of the offerings that I've just described have a certain amount of, I mean, they involve blood. It's not clear exactly whether we're dealing with the propitiation of the wrath of God, but typically at the end of the description, something will be said about forgiveness for the worshiper, or forgiveness for this, or forgiveness for that. So even though it's not really a prominent idea, it's clearly connected in one way or another with propitiating the wrath of God. I mean, it seems to me clear that it's dealing with propitiating the wrath of God. What is not the case is that you just have a prescribed ritual that it and it alone is the way in which you propitiate the wrath of God. That does not seem to be the case. Then, as part of the rituals in the ancient world, you also have ransom or redemption. A ransom or a redemption is just any sort of cost that is endured by the worshiper in order to purchase the freedom of the worshiper or someone else, in some cases, from something. I will argue that when you get to the New Testament, it's freedom from condemnation that is being purchased. But the classic example in the Old Testament is that because of the Passover event in Egypt, where God passed over the firstborn and did not take them, God tells Israel, I own your firstborn, and they are to serve me. Now, well, there's some question among the scholars whether I own your firstborn and you're to sacrifice them to me is the way some people take it. I don't think that's true. They are to serve me, be dedicated. Their life is to be dedicated to the service of Yahweh unless you pay a ransom. And that's what would typically happen in Israel, is the parents of the firstborn would offer the appropriate offering I can't remember how many days into their life, would offer the appropriate offering that redeemed that firstborn. So it freed them to go and live an ordinary life like the rest of the people of Israel. They didn't have to have their whole life dedicated to the service of Yahweh, because they had been ransomed. Redemption had been paid. What's most significant to me is that none of these ancient rituals seem to involve judicial punishment at all. That was striking to me. That just isn't what's happening. The victims are their lives are being taken. They are sacrificing their lives, but they're not being dealt with punitively. They're not being punished. And I think that's significant. Okay, as I said, all of those offerings, all of those rituals, all of that religious stuff going on was widespread in the ancient world. The question is, how are we to look at the Mosaic Covenant in the light of that fact, historical fact? Well, there's two ways of looking at it. One would be to take the perspective that prevails in academic circles, and that is that all ancient religions, including that of Israel, are simply human inventions. They're human beings trying to come to terms with their religious impulses and dealing with the unique dynamic, psycho-emotional dynamic of a human being, a creature, trying to come to terms with his God, if there is one, you know, that sort of idea. So it's really a function of human psychology and sociology more than it is of anything else, and it makes an interesting study to try to go back and trace the evolution of the different practices, the different institutions, the different beliefs, the different attitudes that have evolved over the course of time, manifesting themselves in the religious expression of mankind. Well, if that's the right way to look at it, then that, of course, makes Old Testament religion, the Mosaic Covenant, in its entirety, just an artifact of human culture, just a product of historical development. The Jews are just copycats of the cultures around them. It's no different. It's no more than that. It's not other than that. They have just borrowed and adapted the practices of the whole ancient religious milieu and made them their own. And that's the only significance of it. That's one way to look at it. And I think you should be forewarned when you go into any of the reference works and read them and try to gather information about that. That's going to be the perspective from which most of them are speaking. Sometimes it's more subtle than other times, but inevitably the perspective that they have taken in their researches and in their judgments and in drawing their conclusions is we are just dealing with a cultural phenomenon here. That's all it is. But there's another way of looking at it, and that is that, in fact, what was happening in Israel was, in fact, a divinely revealed religion. This is not just an accident of history that the Jews did what they did and practiced what they practiced and believed what they believed. They had prophets come to them, set apart by the transcendent God himself, Yahweh himself, who is doing a new and different thing in history. He was interjecting himself into history in order to speak into their situation. And he was saying, I want you to do this. I want you to relate to me in this particular way using these tools, these devices, practicing this religion, and so on. That, I would argue, excuse me, is is how the, sorry, I get choked up. That, I would argue, is how the Bible itself presents the history of the Jews. Now, what would the academic person do? Well, of course, that's how they presented it, but it's revisionist history. This stuff has just evolved in their midst, and the scriptures as we know them is just a matter of them going back and rewriting their history and writing it as if God had actually spoken to them. Thank you. As if God had actually spoken to them and revealed these things to them. But we know that's not really the case. That's just the story they're telling us and the story they're telling themselves. Well, my perspective is that at that point, I take the Bible at face value, that this is not revisionist history. This is what actually went down. This is actually what transpired. There really were prophets. There really was a Moses who was God's instrument to shape and fashion and form and create this covenant and this religion that Israel was supposed to engage in. Now, if we take it that way, then what are we to do with the fact that they're doing much the same thing as the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Anatolians and everyone else? What are we supposed to do with all these similarities? Well, some of you will have heard this story before. That my perspective on this was formed when I was in Israel, the only time I was in Israel. We were being led around by an Old Testament professor, Bruce Waltke. Some of you might have read some stuff by him. Bruce Waltke was our guide, an Old Testament professor, and he had been active in some archaeological digs in Israel, and he took me to some of the places that he had been active in. But one of the first places we went was in downtown Tel Aviv. There was a dig, and my memory's playing tricks on me, I believe it was Tel Kassil. And it was kind of fenced off, and this pit in the ground that had been dug down, and all this stuff exposed. And we sat up there looking down into the pit, and he started pointing out, there's the holy place. You can see the pillars that demarcate the holy place. That's the outer court. Outside of that, inside the holy place, those other pillars, those demarcate the Holy of Holies, so on. Well, the thing that was so striking and breathtaking to me at the time was this was a Philistine temple. That this was they had uncovered a Philistine temple. And he made the point that, you know, you could, of course, conclude from the fact that the structure, the architectural structure of the Philistine temple had the same structure as the temple in Israel, that the nation of Israel just ripped it off. You know, they're just copying it. You could conclude that. Or, he said, what makes more sense to him is that the Philistine, he also commented, I should say, that the Philistine temple followed the same pattern as any other temple in the ancient world at that time. I mean, it was not unique to the Philistines. It was shared by virtually all the temples. And he made the point that the architectural structure of the temple actually created a kind of language. It was a kind of language that could be used to communicate things about the people in relationship to their God. And then he went on to point out there was one very radical and distinct difference between the temple in Jerusalem and the temple, this Philistine temple. In this Philistine temple, and we have an account of it in the Old Testament, if you were to go into the holiest room, you would be confronted immediately by this graven image, this statue of Dog, their God. Not D-O-G, D-A-G. That you would have been confronted with a representation, an idol, a graven image of their God, who just was their God, or at least stood, represented their God to them as being present in the Holy of Holies. No such thing would have been found in the temple in Jerusalem. God forbade you to create a graven image of him. You would find no such thing. Instead, you find the Ark of the Covenant, and then we could talk about the significance of the things in the Ark of the Covenant. But whatever, one of the things Walkey pointed out is you'd have the tablets in the Ark of the Covenant. So if the question is, what does God look like? What's the answer in terms of the language of the architecture of the temple in Jerusalem? What's the answer to what God looks like? Well, take a human being who lives like this, the Ten Commandments, and is committed to the moral vision that's embodied in the Ten Commandments, and now you know who God is. So, rather than try to image God for you in the form of a idol, we have a more abstract definition of who God is. God is the God who is good, who is righteous, who is committed to moral values. That's God. Okay, all that's to say, I found his answer there very compelling. That makes a lot of sense to me. That the reason we have the similarities between all the ancient religions and Israel is not because it's merely a cultural artifact, an accident of history that evolved over time. It's because God came into and interjected himself into history at a particular time where particular languages had been developed, concepts had been developed, and God was using the language and concepts of the religious ancient world to tell Israel about himself in terms of those concepts and that language. I think the offerings are the same thing. The offerings are going to be things that are practiced by all the different people around the ancient world, but they mean what they mean in the context of the covenant that God made with Israel. And in order, we have to understand them in the context of the entire covenant in order to understand them. And that I'm not really prepared to do yet, but that would be the standpoint from which I address the question of why there are those similarities. So if of those two ways of looking at it, it's the latter, God really did intervene in history. He really did reveal himself. He really did reveal himself in terms of familiar patterns and familiar institutions and practices. Then it doesn't follow that God intended for Israel to understand the logic and the mechanism of offering and sacrifice and atonement in the same way that the heathen polytheists did. He may very well be using their practices, but he could use their practices and transform their meaning, transform their significance. And I will argue that's exactly what he did. Okay. In that regard, then, my contention is that God never revealed or intended a view of things that saw some sort of intrinsic value in the religious offerings or sacrifices, and certainly not any magical quality to the sacrifices. It may be that the polytheists around him believed in certain magical qualities, certain mechanisms at work in the offerings. That may be, although I don't necessarily trust the scholars who would say so in that regard either, because oftentimes in our sophistication here in the 21st century, we tend to diss ancient people as being more superstitious than they actually were. So I don't know. But even if that was true of polytheism, I would argue that's not true of Yahweh, and it's not true of the Mosaic Covenant. We know this because we have plenty of evidence in the Old Testament itself that God saw the offerings as unnecessary and disposable. And I'll try to make that case here in a second. God saw the logic of the actions of offering not in the value of the actions themselves. Their value was in the inwardness of heart that the actions could possibly reflect. That's crucial to understand that. Way back in the Old Testament, it's inwardness that God is requiring of man, not outward observance, not outward piety and religiosity, but a certain inward orientation, an inward attitude, an inward mindset that makes someone either right with God or not. And I think we have plenty of evidence that that's the way God was looking at it all along. God desired that inward orientation. The outwardness, the outward manifestation of that in ritual, was in and of itself unnecessary and incidental. Okay, in that regard then, let's look first at Psalm 50. I'll just read this, and I want to just comment on part of it. The mighty one, God, Yahweh, has spoken and summoned the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God has shown forth. May our God come and not keep silence. Fire devours before him, and it is very tempestuous around him. He summons the heavens above and the earth to judge his people. Gather my godly ones to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, and the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God. I do not reprove you for your sacrifices, and your burnt offerings are continually before me. I shall take no young bull out of your house, nor male goats out of your folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I shall rescue you, and you will honor me. But to the wicked, God says, what right have you to tell of my statutes and to take my covenant in your mouth? For you hate discipline, and you cast my words behind you. When you see a thief, you are pleased with him, and you associate with adulterers. You let your mouth loose in evil, and your tongue frames deceit. You sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son. These things you have done, and I kept silence. You thought that I was just like you. I will reprove you and state the case in order before your eyes. Now consider this, you who forget God, or I will tear you in pieces, and there will be none to deliver. He who offers a sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me, and to him who orders his way aright, I shall show the salvation of God. So there's a lot there that we can't get into, but it just seems to me the basic thrust of the whole psalm is to dismiss how ineffectual and worthless and valueless offerings are. It says, shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats? Do you really think that's what I want? That may be true of Marduk, but it's not true of Yahweh. That doesn't interest him. What he wants is thanksgiving. He wants people to pay their vows. He wants people to live a certain kind of moral values, embody a certain sort of moral values, and be a certain kind of people rather than another kind of people. That's what he wants. So he ends by saying, now consider this, you who forget God, or I will tell you in pieces, and there will be none to deliver. He who offers a sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me, and to him who orders his way aright, I shall show the salvation of God. It's ordering our way aright. It's having the kind of attitude toward God that we as creatures respond to our Creator in gratitude. That's what God wants. He doesn't want our stinking meat. Some other quotes here. Proverbs 21:3, to do righteousness and justice is desired by Yahweh more than sacrifice. 1 Samuel 15:22. Has Yahweh as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Yahweh? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Proverbs 15:8, the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to Yahweh, but the prayer of the upright is his delight. Notice it's not the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination, but the sacrifice of the righteous is a delight. It's the sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. The prayer, again, an expression of inwardness, I would argue, of the upright is his delight. Hosea 6, and the judgment on you are like the light that goes forth, for I delight in loyalty, chesed, rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Okay, I could multiply these, but I think you've got the idea. Psalm 40, however, is worth looking at. I waited patiently for Yahweh, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay. He set my feet upon a rock, making my footsteps firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and will trust in the Lord. How blessed is the man who has made the Lord his trust and has not turned to the proud nor to those who lapse into falsehood. Many, O Lord, my God, are the wonders which you have done and your thoughts toward us. There is none to compare with you. If I would declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count. Sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. I have proclaimed glad tidings of righteousness in the great congregation. Behold, I will not restrain my lips. O Lord, you know, I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your loving kindness and your truth from the great congregation. And I'll stop there. The author of Hebrews makes a big deal out of that psalm. If you go to chapter 10, let me start reading from the first of the chapter. For the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very form of things, can never by the same sacrifices which they offer continually, year by year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins year by year. Now it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, "Sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, 'Behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God.'" Now he makes an argument from Psalm. After saying above, "Sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law," then he said, "Behold, I have come to do your will." He takes away the first in order to establish the second. By this will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Okay, notice what he's saying. When he says he takes away the first in order to establish the second, what's the first? The first are the offerings. He says, you don't want, in whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. So he takes away the first, he says, in order to establish the second. What is the second? Well, as the psalm goes on, notice the psalmist says, after saying you don't take any pleasure in offerings, he says, "Behold, I have come to do your will, O God." And then the actual psalm, he doesn't quote it here in Hebrews. It goes on to say, "Your law is written in my heart," but he doesn't quote that part. He just says, "Then I said, 'Behold, I have come to do your will, O God.'" So sacrifice is removed and replaced with inwardness. The inwardness of being willing, of an orientation toward God, where I have the willingness to do, to obey God, the willingness to do what God requires of me. And then he ends there, "by this will," and I think what he means by this will that is manifest in, "Behold, I have come to do your will, O God," that is, by this willingness to do the will of God, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus once and for all. So where does the atonement rest, the author of Hebrews is saying? In the offerings? No. The psalm clearly takes away the first in order to replace them with the second. The atonement comes in view of the sacrifice of Jesus. It is granted to people who are willing to obey, are willing to do the will of their Father. So what is the mechanism of the offering? What's the logic of the offering? How does it work? It works simply because God is peering into the heart of the worshiper and judging to either be merciful and forgive their sins or not be merciful and hold their sins against them on simply on the grounds of that mindset that he sees inside of them. Are they or are they not willing to do the will of the Father? Second Samuel 12:13, one other passage that I think is significant for my purposes here. This is where Nathan has come to David to confront him about his murder of Uriah and his adultery with Bathsheba. And after he is an, it is announced that he's the one that Nathan is referring to, 12:13 says, "Then David said to Nathan, 'I have sinned against the Lord.'" Okay, now recognize the scenario. David is king. He's melting from the inside with guilt. We know that from Psalms that he wrote. But Nathan comes and confronts him, tells him a parable about an evil person doing evil things. And David says that evil person needs to be killed. And Nathan, you know, responds to him very courageously, I might add, and says, you're the one, you're the man. Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, and this is critical, and Nathan said to David, "Yahweh also has taken away your sin. You shall not die." Where is the offering? There was no time for any offering in between. God is not taking away David's sin because he liked his offering, because he liked his piety, because he liked his religiosity, because he offered up something that had the power and the efficacy to cleanse. that magically somehow did some magic in God's universe where God now had the freedom to forgive David in a way that otherwise he wouldn't. God just decides. God just declares. He just sovereignly declares, I'm going to be merciful to you, David. You're not going to die. I'm going to forgive your sin. So the question is, if that's true of the Old Testament sacrifices, that they are not ultimately necessary, which I think I've begun to show, could it be true of the sacrifice of Jesus also? That's the question that raises. In other words, does atonement come because of some magical quality to Jesus' blood, to Jesus' death? Or does atonement come because of the inward subjective response of the believer in the context of and with reference to Jesus' death? Now, some will argue, I think, that the Old Testament sacrifices did not have any magical power because they were just animals, after all. It wasn't Jesus dying. But even though the Old Testament sacrifices and the death of those animals had no magical power, Jesus' death does have magical power. And they would emphasize that that's the clear difference between the offerings in the Old Testament and the death of Jesus. They were ineffectual. Jesus' death was effectual. But there's another possibility. Could it be that God has never, not in the Old Testament and not in the New Testament, God has never employed magic to make atonement for our sins? It has always been God responding in mercy to an authentically inward contrition on the part of a human being, just as God responding to David. The only thing that's in view there that you could possibly point to as the ground of God's mercy is David's confession, his contrition, his acknowledgement of his guilt, his sorrow over who he is. I'm going to contend that it's the latter, not the former. It's not that Jesus' death was more magical than animal deaths in the Old Testament. It's that it's never been a question of magic. It's always been a question of God sovereignly determining to be merciful to whom he will be merciful. Now, we're going to have to, let's see. Let me just get into this briefly, and then I'll stop. I didn't get quite as far as I thought I would. But we're now going to go into the New Testament. That's what I want to do, and I'll do that next week. But again, there's two ways of looking at what the New Testament authors are doing as they approach the Old Testament teaching on the atonement. And again, it divides up between what prevails in the academic community on the one hand and what I think is a more straightforward, taking the Bible at face value approach. In the academic community, the tendency is going to be to see Jesus, Paul, Peter, John as creative innovators and reinterpreters. That they're looking at this legacy from the Old Testament that has been passed on down to them and that they've been enculturated into, and they're going, well, can we think about this differently? Do we have to think about this the way I've been taught to think about this, or could we not get creative here and think about this differently? Notice that the assumption behind that is that Christianity is the creation of Jesus and Paul and the other apostles, that they're these creative religious geniuses who transformed human history by taking the resources of one religion and creating out of it an entirely different religion. Okay, you could look at it that way. That goes against the way the Bible represents itself, I would argue. That's not what it says happened. I think the same thing was happening in the time of Jesus that was happening in the time of Moses. That God was interjecting himself into the flow of human history. He was not allowing things to just evolve on their own. God was literally speaking into our situation, setting the record straight, telling us who he was, telling us who we were, revealing what his purposes had always been all along from all of eternity. And he was revealing those things to us through the teaching of Jesus. So when we see the New Testament writers going back to the Old Testament and looking at issues of ransom and redemption and scapegoat and, you know, one person's sins being placed on Jesus, offering blood, when we see them using those resources out of the Old Testament, they are not, in fact, using them for their own purposes to create their own thinking and their own ideas that they are then handing on to us. I'm going to argue that they are actually discovering God's original intent in the Mosaic Covenant. They are seeing what God put there. So they are humble servants of God who God has enlightened to be able to see what the truth is about what God all along had always intended. They are not innovators who are making this junk up. That's my contention. Okay, maybe let's start there next week. And I'll leave time for you to ask your questions.
Hi, Jack. Thanks. So there seemed to my ears to be a tension between the thrust of what you were saying, the main point of what you were saying, which is, you know, said succinctly in Hebrews 10 that you just pointed out, and you see throughout the Psalms and the prophets too, you know, and the prophet Samuel said it also very succinctly, you know, that the outward symbol that the sacrifice itself is not as important as the intent that goes along with it, and that the intent precedes the sacrifice and is...
I'm sorry.
The intent precedes the sacrifice, and that the sacrifice itself is kind of a... Well, we could say it's a fulfillment of that, you know. But when you read through Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, it's just the most initial, you know, striking thing you see about the Israelite religion is the emphasis on the external, it seems. There's just so much information about, like, the specific sacrifices that need to be offered under certain situations,
yep.
The weight of the grain that has to be measured out, like how many steps forward and back you take, what day of the year you do this, mm-hmm. You know, and who can eat it and who can't eat it and when. And it's actually mind-boggling. I mean, to modern people, when you read it, it just seems completely, you know, meaningless.
Yep.
What you said about, you know, the point you were making, you know, is one that we can all kind of relate to more, because it kind of fits more with the modern mind, but yeah, that's where the tension I hear comes from, you know, in making that point and then also saying at the same time, well, that was a divinely instituted religion, you know, that the same God that, you know, that looks into the heart and that's what's important to God, you know, also wanted you to take three steps forward and three steps back, raise it up, raise it down, and if you do it wrong, he's going to strike you down, you know, and that's what seems so weird, you know, about saying both of those things at the same time. So
yeah.
I was wondering what you had to say about that.
That I agree it's weird. No, it is weird. It probably wouldn't strike them as weird as it strikes us. I mean, I think that was implicit in the way you framed the question. I mean, we're in an entirely different time and place in history and culture, and we've been enculturated into different values, many of which have been strongly impacted by the truth of Christianity, which has emphasized inwardness in a way. It would have been much more comfortable to them because everybody was doing that stuff. I mean, all their neighbors, I mean, everybody was doing religion in this particular way where it really mattered whether you put the feathers on the right side of the altar or on the left side of the altar. I mean, so in a way it wouldn't have struck them as strange. That's just what you did. That's how you worshiped God. That's how you served God. So the particulars of that are telling them how to serve God in a way that's familiar to them. The question that's left open is, why do you serve God? And what are you expecting to get out of it, and what is your relationship with God? I mean, those questions are left sort of unaddressed by all that detail stuff. And I think what, as I would read it, what God is doing over time, really from the beginning, but you get, as you go through the history of Israel, you get more and more information that kind of reinforces this, is that God didn't ask them to do religion because he's really into religion. God asked them to do religion because he wanted to be the God they were serving rather than these other gods. They're going to be serving somebody. They're going to be putting blood here and there and slitting throats and cooking meat here and there for somebody. Make it be me, not these other gods. And there are certain implications of that being me. And that's then what he made his project, is to teach them what are the implications then of it being me that you are serving.
But that's the extraneous stuff then, right? I mean,
I'm sorry.
That's the extraneous stuff then, right? The slitting of throats and the, you know, yeah, the boiling the meat and the forks, yeah, and all the utensils and stuff.
Right.
Why didn't he just say, okay, we're not going to do any of that. You know, I don't care about the sacrifice. You just need to follow this ethical code, and here it is.
Well, I need to work on this some more, but I think that's the message of Hebrews. I think that's the message of part of the message of Galatians, is the apostle saying, you know what? None of this stuff really makes sense any longer in view of what we now fully know. And I think in the meantime, God is just waiting for his son to come and put all the last pieces together so that we will know fully what God is up to and know what perspective to take toward that religion. And when we finally have the full perspective, then we know, oh, this is not about religion at all.
Thanks.
I'm aware, you know, when David... Jesus cites David when he comes to the priests at Nob, and he eats the showbread, and the priest says, well, this is only for the priests. He says, well, the men that are with me, basically he's saying, you know, listen, they're the ones who sanctify the bread, not the other way around. The bread doesn't sanctify the man sanctifies the bread. You know, aren't these vessels holy now? They're made in the image of God, basically, is what he was telling the priest. And says, well, as long as they've kept themselves from women, I guess it's okay. So he gets this view that the law is that. It is just an outward thing, and the inward thing is more important and subject to man. And yet he lays up everything to build a house for God, to institute this sacrifice system. You mentioned that sacrifice system, that there was no magic in it, and yet I read in the New Testament, a lot of the identification with Christ's sacrifice is almost a magic thing. It's almost like, you know, he says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part in me. And it is almost like he's calling us vampires and werewolves, you know, flesh-eating, shape-shifting monsters. And I agree with him. I think that's what we are without Christ. And, the idea of these animals are, you know, the cannibals, is they partake of this human flesh and they partake of the characteristics, a magic ritual that they take of the characteristics of that life. I think that's what he's saying. And in a lot of Paul, that's basically what he's saying, that when we are made participants in Christ, it's almost like a magical thing. You know, you're crucified with Christ, you're raised with Christ, you have his life. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. It isn't just a moral influence of saying, look how wonderfully Christ served the Father. Right. It's saying much more than that. He said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no part of me. Now, I can take that as a moral thing, unless I obey Christ, unless I eat his words and make them part of me. I mean, I can interpret it that way. That's true. But I think he's saying something more than that.
Yeah. In the final analysis, I will not try to make the case that there's no magic to our sanctification and to Jesus' death on the cross. I just think we need to be careful where we put the locus of that magic. And what I'm going to argue is I don't think the locus of its magic is in the death or in the blood or, for that matter, even in the resurrection. That's not where the magic that comes to play in my life is. Rather, I will argue that if you want to talk about the magic is in the Spirit of God working in the human heart. And that is very magical. That's true. But the Spirit of God working in the human heart happens in the life of those people who do eat Jesus' flesh and drink his blood and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's coming. I'll have to make my case for that next week.
Getting back to the, you know, is it the heart or is it the mechanics of the sacrifices thing? As I read all those laws about all the offerings and stuff, there are a lot of them. I mean, the others, the mechanics, but there's all these things like it has to be the best of your sheep. Mm-hmm. And in Malachi, one of the things they're in trouble for is they're given the weak ones and the lame ones, and God's saying that's not good enough. And obviously, like you said, it's not that God has some need and for good ones and not bad ones, but that's one of those things where it's obviously, okay, this is a test of your heart. Are you willing to give your best for God? And when he asks for, like, the firstborn, you know, I always, whenever I read that, I think, you know, if I had a, you know, some cattle, and this is the first one this cow is calf, I'm thinking, I want to keep this one because I don't know if there's going to be more or not. And so it's that you have to have faith that you can give the first one or the first fruits of your crops because God's going to give you more. Mm-hmm. And things like keeping the Sabbath, that's something the Jews kept failing to do. Well, why do you not stop working on the Sabbath? It's because you're afraid you won't get your wheat harvested if you don't, or you won't get the money from selling it if you don't. So it seems like even within the sacrificial system, there was a whole lot of things where in order to do it, you had to have faith.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that was its real purpose, its real intent throughout its entirety from the very beginning. To be a test of the human heart.
This just reminds me of a book that I read about a missionary that went into New Guinea with headhunters and stuff there when he was trying to teach these headhunters how to be Christians and stuff, that he had a difficult time teaching them the New Testament, but they understood the Old Testament. And they become Christians through the Old Testament. They always struggled with the New Testament. Just trivial information.
Hmm. Interesting.
Jack, when we look at Genesis, one of the first pictures of my mind, and it's probably with yours also, is that did God inaugurate or institute the first form of sacrifice when he clothed Adam and Eve with a skin? Now, some people would argue it has nothing to do with sacrifice, even though he was to eat every herb of the field. It never said he had to go out and kill an animal, but it does appear that that's what happened. A skin was covering them, which apparently had to give its life. Now, we understand that Abel gave a better sacrifice than Cain. And we read in Hebrews that it was a sacrifice. So when I'm looking at these other nations that try to form these sacrificial rituals, it looks like maybe they were just copying the very original one. In my understanding, it wasn't that they had made it up. Maybe they had word, well, this was from the earliest people that we know.
Okay. The problem is we don't have enough information about what Cain and Abel were thinking with respect to their offerings. We don't have a context for it. We don't have, there's no covenant that we're aware of that they're relating to. So it's hard to know what the meaning of that was. And therefore, it's hard to know, are the other nations just carrying on a kind of tradition that came from the very beginning, or have they distorted something? Mm-hmm. Have they taken something that had one meaning and given it a different meaning? So I think what you're saying could very well be true. I just don't know if we have enough information to do much with that, to know what to do with that.
Yeah, that is true. I just, by faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. This was in Hebrews 11:4. So the word sacrifice, unless it's another terminology there, it's using that word sacrifice. So what I would conclude, not to have enough information to prove.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the Hebrews passage, though, is notice that it's offered as a evidence to Abel's faith. You know, it's his faith that is being represented by that. It's not his piety. It's not his religiosity. It's not his righteousness. It's his faith. And when David taught on Genesis, the point that David made, as I recall, is that what you have in the Genesis account is linguistic emphasis placed on Abel taking the choicest parts of the best part of the animal to offer up to God, and Cain offered some vegetables. It's the thing that Cain mentioned about Malachi. You're offering your weak ones of the flock, not the best ones of the flock. Well, it's dissing God to just go through the motions and offering him some vegetables. That's Cain's lack of faith, is he really doesn't have enough regard for God to give him the best. Now, some people argue that his problem was it was vegetables rather than a meat offering. I don't think that's true. Yeah, that if he had offered the best of the vegetables, he would have been right there on a par with Abel in his faith. But he didn't. That he didn't really have a very high regard for his creator, but Abel did. So
right, and I would look, it was the intent of the heart that God was seeing.
Exactly.
And he says, right. If you do well, will you not be respected? And if you don't, then sin lies at the door.
Right.
And you should rule over it. He says that. But what I'm looking at is the word sacrifice, not so much I agree with the intent of the heart, but the word sacrifice. I'm just looking at in
Hebrews. What's your point with regard to that?
The point is that the word sacrifice is the first time in history.
Oh, okay.
Going back to the earliest day, that maybe it's used even in the New Testament, not anywhere else, referring back.
Okay, right. So. No, that's true. Yeah. Way back then, they're already doing offerings, sacrifices. Yeah.
I was just wondering what you meant by the word magic. When you use the word magic, what do you mean by that?
Well, look at the language that gets used about cleansing the altar or cleansing cleansing the worshiper. Is it because the blood of the animals have some chemical that have this incredible ability to dissolve blame, ritual uncleansedness and so on, uncleanness and so on? Is it literally doing something effectively, causing a condition to change from this state to this state by the power inherent in the blood of the animal or the sacrifice? Or for that matter, by the power inherent, the spiritual power inherent in the very act, if it's combined with outward observance and inward rightness of heart? Is there some power that literally transforms the spiritual, moral, metaphysical state of things? That would be a kind of magic, as I see it. Or take the scapegoat. You know, is it that when the high priest puts his hands on the goat and confesses the sins of Israel over it, do the sins jump off of me, an Israelite, and onto the goat? And so when the goat is taken off into the wilderness, literally, my sins have been taken off of me through static electricity, stuck to the goat, and taken away. That would be magic. And that's what I'm... Anything that sees mechanism involved here in accomplishing forgiveness, propitiation, cleansing, whatever, through some kind of metaphysical mechanism, I would call magic.
Okay, so some kind of necessary cause-effect relationship that was independent of God's deciding to respond to something by some action on his part.
See, in, is it The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Aslan is slain by the White Witch, and the assessment is that the witch knew the magic, but she didn't know the deeper magic. That God, or Aslan, wanted to accomplish something, but he could only accomplish it because he had to work within the rules of the cosmos, the rules of reality. Typically, that's the way we think about Jesus' death on the cross, and typically that's how we think about these Old Testament rituals by analogy, is that God wants to forgive us, but he has to work within the, you know, within the rules of reality. And lo and behold, someone showed God what has the cleansing power to be able to erase moral guilt, and so he's instituted that in the religion to be able to bring it about that we can be cleansed of our moral guilt within the rules of reality. And it really comes down in the end to what's our view of God, I think. Because what I'm saying, I have a different concept of God than that. God doesn't have to work mechanically within the rules of reality. All God needs to do is speak, and it will be so. All God needs to do is want something to be the case, and it becomes the case. So God doesn't need to use means at all in order to bring about our salvation and our forgiveness and our redemption and so on. All God needs to do is say, let Jack be clean, and Jack is clean. It's not more complicated than that for God.
So I thought you said later on that it really ultimately is by magic, but it sounds like you were changing the meaning of magic in that situation. You were saying ultimately it is magical.
Well, what I mean by saying that is that my sanctification in the New Testament is a very supernatural, unnatural, abnormal direction for a human being to go. Left to myself as a natural-born human being, I would not become sanctified. God really is invading my life and giving me new yearnings and longings and desires and priorities and values. And that it strikes us and we experience it as almost magical because we wake up 15 years later and go, what happened to me? Where'd that come from? Because God, as he says to Nicodemus, is like the wind. You know, you don't know where it's coming from or where it's going, but it rattles the leaves nonetheless, you know. I am left changed when the wind of the Spirit of God blows through my existence. One more.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. Let's see. So I was writing down, you know, I'm trying to get the gist of this all. What is God's issue with the deaths of animals and Jesus? And then I'm assuming that maybe I can summarize what you were saying, that mankind know right from wrong. Would that be a direction you're going?
So I missed the question. Why does what?
What is God's issue with the deaths of animals and Jesus? Is this the place you're going, that mankind know right from wrong?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
No. I think it's that mankind might know their Creator.
Okay.
And specifically, that mankind might come to know their Creator as a profoundly merciful person.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
I think that's what it comes down to.
Thanks.
Okay, I've kept you over. I better let you go. Thank you.